This program was produced at and first aired on MPR, Manawatu People's Radio, with support from New Zealand On Air. Ka pai, Irirangi Tumotu, MPR.
Kia ora and welcome to Reserved Recommendations. This is a show about great trash, difficult art, and our complicated relationships with art and culture. My name's Hugh, I'm the host of the show, and I'd like to take this opportunity to put in a very mild content warning for the show as a whole. Sometimes our recommendations on this show are reserved just because the thing that we're discussing is in some way not good, but sometimes there are aspects of the art or artist that may be confronting for some people. Check the episode descriptions for more information, and do be aware of your listening environment. That's right, you're listening to Reserved Recommendations. This is a radio show and podcast produced by Manawatu People's Radio, Te Reo Irirangi o ngā tangata o Manawatu, with the support of New Zealand On Air. This evening I am talking to Lewis Tennant. How is it going?
Good, thank you, Hugh. Lovely to see you again out of our natural annual yearly environment.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. The peek behind the curtain here is that Lewis and I usually meet at the New Zealand Podcasting Summit, and our paths don't often cross otherwise because Lewis is in Auckland, and so we won't generally just randomly bang into one another. But I've been bothering you for a while to come on the show, and I've finally managed to get it to happen, which is really cool. And I wonder if I can get you to explain the topic, because I'm just not quite sure how to encapsulate it into a sentence.
Well, actually, by the way, I listened to a few episodes, and I wonder whether I should have gone down the more kind of schlock pop culture path and indulged my long history of going to the Incredibly Strange Film Festival, etc. But firstly, before I explain, yeah, what is your encapsulation of the sort of things you cover on the show as things that kind of don't easily slot into kind of mainstream understanding? Is that kind of a nice broad?
The very short version is great trash and difficult art. And so great trash is, I don't like the term guilty pleasure. I don't think you should feel guilty about your pleasures. I think it's okay to like stuff which is trash, and to say this thing which I enjoy is trash, and here's why I enjoy it despite it being trash. But also I'm interested in conversations about art where you might not think it's trash. You might think it's great, but you would also not necessarily just recommend that any person dive into it, because there are elements to it which are difficult or complex or confronting or any of that stuff. And I mean, this is a music episode, and I will say I've been listening to the music that you recommended as a starting point, and doing like some surfacey research into the artists, and there's definitely some difficult art stuff to talk about there.
Oh, I know what you mean by that, difficult art. I interpret difficult more broadly as to why I chose it, in that, let's just go with why I like it to begin with. I chose a couple of reggae artists that more broadly represent quite a sort of, I guess, heavier, deeper, sometimes more aggressive, but definitely sonically more unusual palette than typical reggae. And what I mean by typical reggae, and part of why I wanted to discuss it, I thought it'd be a good topic on the show, is that I think often reggae and also Rastafarian culture and just that whole history of kind of Africans in Jamaica is often quite shallowly portrayed in popular culture, often by not people not meaning any harm. You know, often you mention reggae, actually the general public's got better with a lot of subject matter since, you know, the time we've been alive. But, you know, the classic thing back in the day would be, oh yeah, and you sort of, someone pretends they're sort of, you know, puffing on a huge joint and going, yeah, man. But also that the sound of reggae, like when we think about, say, for example, what became quite well known as the Wellington sound from like the late 90s, early 2000s, there is some heavier, deeper stuff. But a lot of that stuff, and no shade on the artists, if any of them were to hear this, it's not me interrogating or like deriding the quality of that music. It's just got quite a lightweight, that kind of that thing they say where they say kind of barbecue reggae, which is used as a pejorative. Whereas this, where the music I'm discussing, the two artists I chose, Sizzla and Capaldan, are what you'd call quite militant Rasta music, but also music that preaches really strong messages of Rastafari, like self righteousness, freedom against oppression, etc., etc. That all sounds very high minded. That's not why I got into it, and I got into it in a kind of pre-modern internet world, so, you know, I've learned a lot of stuff after the fact. It's just because that music really moves me when I hear it, which kind of also fascinates me, as far as I know, I've never done a 23andMe, but a fairly kind of straight up and down Scottish, English, European white fellow. And then to just one last thing, you got me started now. I thought I'd have nothing to say today. Lucky. When you talk about the difficulty, we'll get to that too, because that's really interesting in terms of, like, a lot of art can be challenging in this way, in that some of that messaging is actually, I really struggle with, which is probably an understatement. But that comes from part of the culture and religion that music derives from. Yeah.
I was gonna say about the kind of the barbecue reggae thing. I think, you know, you could write entire theses about the impact of Bob Marley on New Zealand culture and reggae, like as perceived in popular culture globally. And I think, in many ways, like Bob Marley and the Wailers are kind of victims of their own success because they became, towards the end of their career, so astoundingly well produced. You know, I remember a documentary about them where I think it must have been what's his name from Island Records saying the thing about producing Bob Marley records is that Bob's voice had this really cutting quality, which meant that you could just layer more and more shit on them, and as a consequence, they're like almost over rich in a lot of ways, and that's the sonic template that I think a lot of people have picked up.
Yeah, and there was that one particular album when that series of album docos came out, fellow nerd, sometime in the late 90s, where they'd unpack an album. That sort of stuff was less common than now. I think maybe the particular album you might be referring to, although I get what you more broadly mean, is Catch a Fire, where they literally kind of like packaged that for a US like rock album market. So even the fact that the kind of cover opened like a Zippo and stuff, but that's when their sound got particularly where you speak of. But let's not lose sight of the fact that Marley himself and then Tosh long after he died are also, you know, in their own way quite militant Rastas, and the music certainly wasn't lightweight like some of the more kind of like summer festival bands we speak of. That was very diplomatic.
No, absolutely. And I mean, there's the famous, or at least I think of it as famous, reissue of Catch a Fire, where they package the Jamaican version of the album along with the American one, and the difference between those is stark and also really interesting. I think, I mean, if you want to go around assigning actual blame in a criminal sense, you'd probably be pointing at people like UB40 and that sort of thing. But to return to the two artists that you were talking to, Sizzla and Capaldan, these are both guys who are a bit later than that, right? Their music is they're kind of in their heyday through the early 90s, have I got?
I would have been a bit late to it, but I would say, look, who knows on the floor in Jamaica, but I reckon mid-late 90s and early 2000s was – and these guys, by the way, I realised maybe you were going to follow up with a question from that before I launch off again. Okay. These guys, yeah, you got to remember, like, it's another interesting idiosyncrasy of Jamaican artists, probably occurs elsewhere as well, but they tend to be, like, prolific – recorders, and literally for prolifically in the studio, and literally for better or for worse. I mean, again, hello internet. I had no idea, because I tend to think most of my musical sort of like the people I'm into are generally quite a bit older than me. But I've since found out, via the internet, that a lot of kind of rappers and so on around my age. I get to the point that Sizzla's born in 1976, which makes him my age, and the guy's already recorded 53 or 54 albums. It's just ridiculous. But I say all of that to say, yeah, they're prolific kind of producers of what we'd kind of call content now. But Sizzler in particular released two or three, I guess you'd call kind of seminal or look to albums, yeah, mid to late 90s. Capaldon's a bit older, and he came up kind of more through the dance hall DJ thing and has become more of a singer later in life. You know that difference, that thing with calling a Jamaican artist a DJ? You know what a DJ means over there?
Yeah, it's the guy who does what's essentially like the precursor to rapping over records, right?
Yeah, good. Yeah. And since then, I mean, it's not like I still follow these guys inside out by any means. If I'm honest, one of the great losses of me really getting into podcast listening is that I listen to next to no music these days, where it used to rule my life. But I say that to say, since then, my kind of ear, literally in a record shop when I was living in Melbourne, which is how we did things back then, no back information or anything, I'd like to say is probably pretty good. Because since then, when I have indulged on YouTube and so on, like Sizzler and Capaldon are huge artists in Jamaica and globally. And then I see those kind of more like, I guess, broader seals of approval. Like I've seen Sizzler with a full orchestra, you know. So, yeah, interesting trajectory.
Yeah, absolutely. It's an interesting point you make about there being an enormous amount of content from these guys, because I do think that goes back into the history of reggae music, and it's probably, this is me speculating wildly off the top of my head, but it wouldn't surprise me if it was related to the sound system culture.
Totally.
So the sound system culture was about essentially guys having the biggest, baddest PA and having literal gangsters who would show up and like beat up other DJs and wreck their PAs. But also having the access to the best new records. And so a constant supply of new singles, and a lot of people covering other people's stuff or doing the same song, but under a different name, all that kind of stuff.
You are so leading to what I think one of the main reasons for it is, which is rhythm culture, which is like producers, put myself on the spot for some names, Bobby Digital, who died a few years ago, producers in Jamaica will make a rhythm, which is obviously patois for a rhythm, or what you'd call in hip-hop parlance a beat, and then there's a competitive nature to that, where like every MC worth his salt will get on that same rhythm, and there's compilations of them, long series. VP Records out of the US used to release a lot of those Jamaican rhythm series, I'm not sure if they do. And, you know, like you might personally like 6 or 7 out of the 15 when you listen, but inevitably 1 to 3 or 4, I'm just sort of pulling numbers here, kind of become baked into the culture. So one particular artist will really hit it with a particular rhythm. And then after I was really deep in that scene and playing a lot of that music out, you know, not everywhere, but you know, at kind of gigs where that stuff aligned, we were buying sevens. I'd go to a guy called Jesse Eyes in his flat in Melbourne. He was going to Jamaica and bringing them over. But I give you that anecdote to lead to now, where it's become even easier for them again, because obviously now we've got an MP3 kind of file-driven culture. But, you know, I guess the point of that end of that story is, you know, the prolific output is quite impressive. It's obviously like a ride or die, you know, live, breathe, and get better and better and better at your craft as you go.
Yeah, yeah. Absolutely. And I mean, I think because of the economics in Jamaica all the way back to the 60s and 70s, it's kind of always been like that. Like your roots out of poverty are small and slim and narrow. And if you can get together a good band or a good group, or you've got the gift of being a really skilled MC or whatever it is, and you can keep those skills up and keep yourself, you know, out in front of the sound systems, then that can be a route of doing that that doesn't require, you know, all those other kinds of connections and resources that maybe you don't have.
Yeah, and obviously with the world getting smaller in our lifetimes, you know, metaphorically, but it feels like, you know, pretty much literally, doesn't it? Those connections are easier to make for Jamaican artists now, and a lot of Jamaican artists are really big in the US. Obviously, there's a whole lot of reasons I thought this is an interesting topic to talk about, because also another strain of lineage of music that just kind of moves me, and I've always been interested in, derives from that, which is all the kind of what you call bass music that comes out of London. Obviously, that's Jamaican diaspora. But I had a point to make with what you said about the, oh, yes, this is another reason I think it's interesting to point out, who maybe people who, you know, who like reggae or like Bob Marley but don't know much about the broader culture or industry and so on, if you haven't thought about it, dear listener, that tiny little island with a relatively very small population compared to the rest of the earth has had a significant, and that's an understatement, musical stamp on global music. The first Jamaican hip-hop DJs, US hip-hop DJs were Jamaicans. A couple of the, few of the early MCs were. All of that British line of music. The way that electronic music's produced now, which a lot of it comes from drum and bass and similar, a lot of that's inevitably comes from sound system and African Jamaican culture.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think you see across the Pacific, particularly, I wouldn't be surprised if there are other indigenous cultures who've done similar things, though.
Wait one second there.
Yeah, huh?
This is not indigenous people. It's Jamaicans. It's pivotal to reggae music. It's African people taken from their homeland and brought up as slaves in Jamaica. The native Jamaicans actually, I don't know a lot about them, but unsurprisingly, being in the Americas, they look like Native Americans. Yeah.
The connection I was making was that there's this whole, you see it in New Zealand, particularly with Māori and Pacific bands, there's this whole cohort of bands who've received the message about like standing up to oppression and have gone, oh yeah, you mean the struggle for indigenous rights. And so they're making, essentially, they've repurposed the reggae stance from that perspective. That's the thing I was talking about.
Yeah, sorry, and I didn't mean to like, I wanted to make that point because I thought about it in the last week, thinking about talking, and that was another thing, totally more for listeners. It's often easy to think kind of black or brown people. I know this is not what you're doing, but it's like, it seems to make sense that Jamaican reggae music is an indigenous music. The New Zealand connection is really interesting. Again, like you being kind of a pop culture nerd, you would have heard this over the years. You know, people often cite that Bob Marley concert because he played there. He played here just before he passed, right? And that's always sort of been, yeah, it's been cited as kind of literally that concert and the time immediately following turned on a whole lot of Māori and Polynesian people to kind of playing and making reggae music. And you're right, they related to the messaging. But there's a really great documentary. I lose track of time now that I'm late 40s. So I'm going to say sometime in the last 4 years, someone made a really great documentary along the lines of When Bob Marley Came to New Zealand, which is on TVNZ On Demand, and it features a whole lot of artists right through from then till now talking about it. It's really worth a look. Yeah.
There's a great fictionalized account in a movie called Mount Zion as well. A trio featuring Stan Walker and Troy Kingy and another guy whose name I forget, competing to be the band who will open for Bob Marley when he comes in the early 80s. It's really cool.
Another wee interesting New Zealand kind of like, 1970s, 80s reggae anecdote carries through the modern day, because that's how I see the band Catch a Fire is kind of feeling and sounding. A band like Fat Freddy's Drop, where I think New Zealanders kind of know they're successful overseas. I don't think a lot of people know quite how the extent of success. Catch a Fire in North America a lot of the year, to my understanding, because they're freaking huge in Hawaii. They're like huge in Hawaii. They draw an audience like any big American or British band would coming here. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I get sent occasional tracks from Hawaiian reggae bands, so I know that that thing really connects with them as well. So to return to Sizzler and Capleton, though, these are both guys whose primary connections outside of Jamaica are to the UK, right?
Yeah, but I think probably the US as well. Like, by the way, I should have said this at the beginning. An academic, and I've done a bit of what's the flash academic term for writing in this area, ethnomusicological research. This conversation comes with no cliff notes or APA 6. I'm doing the 7th now. I'm doing my best, so I might get some of the details slightly out. But anyway, my point is, yeah, there. But I think with the internet, probably spread a lot of places. I would say that, you know, Vibes Cartel, who's another artist. Different artist stylistically, but of that kind of reggae dancehall revival, late 90s onwards. He lives in the US now. I know that Beanie Man and Buju Banton, who are kind of probably better known to more listeners than the two artists we're talking about, base themselves in the States now. This is a long way around saying, but I'm not sure, Hugh. I think they're probably bigger a lot more places now. Yeah, yeah.
Right. That's possibly a mistake on my part. Where it came from was that I know that there have been kind of successive waves of Jamaican and Caribbean migration to the UK, which have led to it having this odd connection to Jamaican culture outside Jamaica, musically speaking.
Yeah, and like I said, those sound systems you spoke of, yeah, they were first exported via what's it called, the Windrose immigration. Windrush immigration, right? So a lot of modern, let's call it bass music artists in the UK, their uncles or great uncles or grandfathers, probably grandfathers now, I think about it, were a lot of the people that operated those sound systems. Yeah, and if you trace through, you could actually, I'm sure someone's done it, you could draw a family tree of British music styles that we know well, jungle, grime, drill. You know, obviously there's a lot more African immigrants in London now and they're involved as well. But back then, yeah, all of this traces back to Jamaica. So yeah, Sizzler and Capleton would have a big impact there. In fact, I listened to a podcast with three London-born guys from different parts of Africa, and they often play Sizzler and Capleton tracks at the beginning. So there you go. Yeah.
So I guess one of the things that was interesting listening to these guys is that I had been a keen reggae listener, but I got into it through my dad having lots of ska records and in terms of, you know, two-tone British ska, and then kind of working backwards from there. And so the music that was more contemporary for me kind of passed me by, but it's interesting to hear the way in which that that Rasta philosophy is kind of being, I guess, presented for a new era, right? Like it's the same roots and culture, but it's addressing kind of late 90s concerns.
Yeah, just read the sonics of it briefly and, you know, what you're used to. It's interesting, yeah, because ska, like, for me, that music, this might sound corny, but that style of music, that one drop, that really heavy, and that style of tempo reggae, I know it's what I like when I kind of, like, it kind of loosens up my lower back, where ska's on a very different tempo, right? It's boom, 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 boom. That stuff's a completely different feel. So for me, who's always been, like, I guess, drums and bass and rhythm first before lyrics and so on, to me they're quite different musics. Yeah, but you asked something else about it and now we've probably both forgotten. I think the concerns of the music, and I think you related it to the beliefs and faith stuff as well, which is totally tied up with it, the core messages kind of don't really change through that music. Like, as I say, you know, smashing down Babylon, freedom from repression, you know, hello slavery, being, you know, born of a slave culture. For those who don't know, like, Rastafari is actually a really modern religion. It's a 20th century thing. There's a guy, Marcus Garvey, who, now that you've heard that, you'll hear referred to all the time in reggae music, who was actually a bit of a transatlantic businessman, and he came up with the idea of a black star liner to take people back to Africa. And he also prophesies that, this is where I say Cliff Notes APA, I'll get this vaguely right, that Africa would have a new leader who would be like, he inspired Rastafari faith, and that's Haile Selassie that you hear about. You hear that in music, you think that sounds like an 1,000-year-old reference. No, no, no. If you Google it, Haile Selassie, I think, became emperor of Ethiopia in the 20s or the 30s. It's quite modern history. That aside, the other message is, you know, they're good. It's that thing of, like, I'm just guessing you might be similar, and that some of the basic, like, tenets of a lot of religions are really good about how to live as a human, you know? So a lot of its messages around that, around, like, capitalism, like, I don't exactly memorize lyrics, but often those rusty musicians have a really great way of putting all of this stuff in really simple terms. Like, I think a line from Sizzler is, like, everybody wants to raid the barn, nobody wants to plant the corn. I mean, right? Where the messages get into that, I think what we call difficult end, from where we're standing or sitting, is Rastafarianism isn't just Rastafarianism. There's actually different sects, and some of them are more militant, or I guess what you'd call like fundamentalist. And Sizzler and Capaldon are both what you call Bobo Dread, and Bobo Dread have some pretty, what does draconian mean? What does draconian mean? They have some pretty old-fashioned, to my sensibilities, ideas around kind of, I guess, essentially patriarchy, but also the stuff that's had the most press is, like, you know, overtly kind of homophobic content. Something a bit more lightweight than that, and kind of understanding that culture and sort of seeing these artists visually, is often when you see a artist in, with their locks in a large turban, that's actually a part of being a Bobo Rasta, of kind of keeping your dreads covered. Similar, I guess, now I'm talking to being a Sikh, although they might be for quite different reasons. I'm not sure how deep Capaldon is in that in terms of living it, but I know that Capaldon, like, literally, that Sizzler, like, literally lives in a Bobo community, is one of the head people there. So that's a bit of an overview of kind of what inspires the music. Yeah.
I am talking to Dr. Lewis Tennant about...
Oh, you're a doctor now, all of a sudden.
Well, I decided I should remember to give you your title. Yeah. About the reggae music of the late 90s, particularly Sizzler and Capaldon. We are around about the halfway point of the show, so we're going to take a very brief break for station messages. We will be back right after this.
If you're enjoying this podcast in Manawatu, you could make your very own, just like this one. NPR exists to help people like you tell your story or share your passion on air and online. Check out npr.nz for more information. Support this show and others like it by giving a donation. For more information, go to www.npr.nz/donate. If you enjoy this NPR podcast, please consider subscribing. Our podcasts are available on all major podcasting platforms: Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and Spotify, as well as the accessmedia.nz app.
You're listening to Manawatu People's Radio. Te Reo Irirangi o ngā tangata o Manawatu. This is Reserved Recommendations, a radio show and podcast produced with the assistance of New Zealand On Air. So cheers for that, guys. Today I am talking to Dr. Lewis Tennant about Sizzler and Capaldon, and I guess more broadly, like, the reggae music and bass music of the late 90s, and the complications of, amongst other things, connecting, like, aesthetically with music that has this really deep and quite radical philosophical and political foundation. You were just talking before the break about how some of these religious messages are quite unsympathetic to modern audiences, particularly when it comes to, like, kind of gender essentialism and tolerance for sexualities and that sort of thing. I think also, you know, these people are not joking about their radical politics and radical in the sense of straightforwardly rejecting the kind of state that they refer to as Babylon. Like they're
well, if you're you know, directly descended from people who are put in a boat and taken to a tiny island, you know, what else is there but to be radical and against the system, or the shitstem, as their ilk like to refer to it as.
That is actually a really interesting point, the shitstem thing, because one of the things that I find really interesting, just kind of endlessly fascinating about the bits of Rasta theology that you get through reggae music, essentially, is that they have this approach that some of the time almost seems like theology by puns. Like the whole thing about saying down presser because it pushes you down rather than lifting you up.
And you have to overstand, not understand.
Exactly.
And you have an earth day, not a birthday.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. All of this stuff where it sounds on one level like a kind of silly semantic game, but they're using it to make this quite deep philosophical point.
Well, this is why I pointed out, and this is the part that I didn't articulate well, but that's fine because we went somewhere else, is that, and it's part of why I wanted to talk about this music today, is because, as I say often, you know, in worst case scenarios, some people can kind of write off the lyrics and the music is really simplistic. Whereas I see the better end of the messaging, which is most of it, as I say, around you know, being a good human, as they sort of boil it down to its essence with sort of phrases and idioms that stick with you. You know, I've been known to use a kind of few Jamaican phrases in my emails at work where I can get away with it because they sum up sort of things you can kind of have big committee meetings about and this, that, and the other in quite an eloquent short fashion. So someone who's a bit of a thinker will look at that and go, oh, okay, does that make sense? You know? Yeah.
The thing that I think is really powerful about it that, and I think this is one of the things that Pacific communities, for example, have grabbed onto, is there's this real tradition of almost doing like judo with the language. Like someone in a position of power says something to you, so you grab the words and you turn them around and you make them into your own thing and you give them back.
Again, it's about subverting the system, isn't it? We do sound like a couple of white men discussing this. By the way, the other reason I wanted to talk about it, which is great, the other reason I wanted to talk about it today is just the sonic quality of it, because I remember I met a guy in Melbourne where I was working, and it just turned out he was like super into music and we had quite similar paths. And then I'd just come onto Sizzler and I played him some of it, and I could just tell that sonically it was just so completely not what he could kind of dig, but he kind of got why I like it. Like, did you kind of connect with it in any way, or was it just too far out in one direction for you?
I really did connect with it because, I mean, I'd been getting into the like hairier and weirder side of 70s reggae. And so this is like a logical through line from that to this, right? Like through the early dance hall people, you end up here. And I think the sonics are really interesting because the way that like reggae bands can often be quite large and unwieldy seeming from the perspective of a rock fan. But the way that works is that they have this philosophy where every single element has its own spot and nothing treads on anything else. So you can have an enormous number of elements and what should be this incredibly dense mix, but it all sits and works. And it's really clever.
So what we should point out to listeners, and the great thing these days is you don't need to go to some pointy-headed record store or Real Groovy or whatever and dig through and try and find one of these records. You can just sort of like bring up Capitan or Sizzler on – I'm not a Spotify guy, but, you know, YouTube, wherever you find digital music. And hopefully the algorithms will serve you, you know, sort of the big ones that are probably the place to start. But I think one thing you and I haven't pointed out with why the music can sound really radical to a lot of people, is the way they both use your voices. Like, Sizzler goes through all different ranges. Sometimes he sings off key, but it kind of, when it doesn't work, it doesn't, if I'm honest, but when it works, it does. He can go from a sort of a dance hall-y kind of, you know, that thing where you, with the back of your throat, where you close up.
Yeah. The thing
but he's
that,
not actually, but he's not actually, sorry, go on. Yeah.
The thing that if you're a mainstream music fan, Shaggy ripped off, basically.
Yeah, but he's actually not doing dance hall. He's still kind of singing. And then Capaldon, as his career progresses, goes from being kind of straight up dance hall to like more kind of that righteous reggae singing. But they don't sing that, I've never really thought about articulating before. This is good for me, Hugh. They don't sing that righteous reggae style in a like Gladiators, Bob Marley kind of like beautiful harmony style. There's almost, this is where I can introduce a bit of humor into the mix, and I've wondered about this because of one of my other weird obsessions that continues from childhood. They're almost Muppety in a way. Like,
you're okay. Right. What they're doing is they're
modulating
their voices into really specific pitches and ranges,
yeah.
And it makes it sit in the mix, but it also makes it expressive in a way that's quite unusual compared to rock music, for example.
And so my last little indulgence here is what happens is, you know, because some people just do not connect with this music. I get it. There's things I just do not connect with. I get why people do this, that, and the other. But if you combine that thing with a few things we've talked about around the musical side of it, which, you know, at the end of the day is probably the most important thing, that Jamaican sound system culture, the rhythms, and those voices, like, it's that sort of music where if you hear it on a huge sound system, their voices combined with their timing, with the bass dropping, like, it's that whole idea of it, you know, people lose their minds. It's a really amazing experience when it's done well. Like, I remember when I went to Notting Hill Carnival in 2000, like, I've said this on my podcast, my now finished podcast a few times, like, and it sounds kind of cheesy, but it happened, like, I kind of had tears of joy that day at some of those sound systems because it just so connects. You know, it is a spiritual music if you get it, and I'm not really a spiritual person.
No, absolutely. There was a band who kind of never went on to greater things for a variety of reasons, but played around Dunedin when I was a teenager and in my 20s, called Zavuya, who had started out as a heavy metal band, but then they got rastified and became like very strong anarchist rather than any other kind of political stripe rasta. And when they were at their peak, it was like the kind of group consciousness that people talk about at the very best kind of electronic shows, because they would just kind of lock into these enormous grooves and everyone would be suddenly kind of on the same wavelength. And it's that kind of thing is absolutely incredible to be at or be part of.
Well, I was, I've been at Move from Fat Freddy's Tangi for a couple of days last week. Because I know him from, you know, well from my student radio days, but also I was part of a reggae sound system collective with him for a while, which has a much broader history than the time I was involved. But yeah, for people who don't know, this might be screamingly obvious, that's kind of exactly what Freddies are doing. They might have had that quite poppy album in New Zealand, but their shows are about that big, long, kind of locked-in jam with Moo, rest in peace, kind of providing all these sonics and echoes and all of that over what the instrumentation's doing. So yeah, totally. Jumping back a bit, if I haven't already said this, because I think it's an interesting connection to make, or a topic or two back, the Rastafarian Bobo Dread in particular thing, and this will give a lot of sense as to why a lot of it feels quite archaic, a lot of it is drawn from Christian Old Testament. My Bible knowledge is not flash at all, but my understanding is that's not the best of the two testaments. Yeah. It hasn't really been remixed for 2025. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And like I said, it's that thing of taking the thing that's been given to you. So religion was absolutely wielded in all of the slave colonies, not just Jamaica, as a tool of social control against the enslaved people. And one of the things that Rasta is a process of taking that and turning it back again.
Yeah. Don't know what makes me think of this. I just think it's an interesting phenomena, and it relates to my relationship with that whole culture and being a fan, and even, you know, going out and playing those records, having been in the orbit of some of those artists, not the two we speak of. I've always been quite aware of the specifics of, I guess, the culture and religion around it, So I've always found it quite an interesting phenomena of kind of the person who gets really, really, really into the music, who then turns to Rasta but is white. And I'm getting into, like, difficult territory here because I'm not dissing that. I just don't understand it based on the kind of repatriation to Africa and so on. But a humorous kind of thing around that is when I lived in Europe, the inevitably, like, very tall Aryan, like 6'4", because the Germans, you know, there's reggae is really big in pockets around Europe. And also around that scene when I lived in Melbourne, there was similar. I don't know where I was going with that, but if only just to point out, yeah, it's a thing where another reason I want to introduce it today is, like, I kind of know I'm not a part of that culture, but there's a lot of us around. And also I heard someone else say this, I've stolen this, you get these kind of mad record collectors in reggae and dub and soul and jazz and all these black styles, and someone somewhere along the line in my life in an interview said, well, archiving isn't really a black guy thing, it's a white guy thing. So there's that as well. Yeah. If you look at guys like Rodigan, there's this old, he'd be mid-70s and he looks like that teacher on South Park, and he's like one of the biggest reggae and sound clash DJs in the world. The Jamaicans really respect him. Yeah, he looks like a maths teacher, but he's got dub plates from all the big guys bigging him up.
I saw the Scatterlights when they came to New Zealand. This is a long while back, but the guy who's holding the rep, because that band, you know, they were like everybody's rhythm section in the late 60s. Like they're really getting on, and a lot of them have died. But the guy who's holding it together is this piano player who looks like a chartered accountant. He's a white guy with a piano keyboard tie, and he looks like a chartered accountant, but he's really locked in there, and he's holding the whole thing together.
When Rodigan started doing clashes, clashes are where, you know, like battling and b-boying, or I guess, like the most, probably most well-known is Eminem's 8 Mile for the hip-hop thing. But when Rodigan, I went to this thing called the Red Bull Music Academy in 2000 in Dublin, and we had a bunch of guest speakers, and Rodigan was one of them. And he talked about, I don't know when he started clashing, how much earlier before that, but he must have been pretty relatively or much more unknown than he kind of is now. Again, thank you, internet. Also, he's on BBC, this, that, and the other now. But he told a story about, bearing in mind, I've talked about kind of how he looks, and also like how a hardcore Jamaican reggae crowd looks. Like, they're actually not kind of big on outsiders a lot of the time. And he clashed over there, or maybe in New York. I don't know the exact details of where, but it was like not really a place you'd see a South Park teacher, maths teacher looking guy. But he was already quite connected, and he talked about kind of, you run a tune. So one guy runs his tune, or one crew run their tune, then you run theirs, and it's sort of like the crowd decides who wins. And the Fugees were like, you remember when the Fugees were just super huge? So Rodigan, with everything I've described, in the height of Fugees fame, pulls a record, puts it down, puts the needle down, and it's Wyclef Jean just bigging up David Rodigan for the whole thing, and apparently the whole crowd went, you know, and that's a story I remember. That's a story I remember from 25 years ago. I'm like, yeah, that's fucking cool.
Yeah, it's really fucking cool.
Yeah. So there's that, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, the Sound Clash thing is interesting, right? Because like battle rapping, in some ways it's a way to work out some tensions that exist within a community without actually having to do violence. and then you get this whole like fan culture of people from outside it. And it's both fascinating and kind of an odd thing to be spectating.
Yeah, I think now these days it's and again I'm not up on music anywhere near like I used to be, but I think battling and beefs and all of that now is more often like really clever kind of you know, worked out marketing and strategy campaigns. I think of like the Kendrick and Drake beef and so on. But yeah, that's its origins. I don't know what I think about. I mean, I do like those sound clashes. It can be done really well and really fun, like anything. You know, and it's about just who is really impressive at something. But I always found when, like, you know, I've DJed and collected records for many years, and you know, I've got pretty good at the craft kind of mixing and stuff like that. But I always found when that turntablism thing got really big and they had battles around that, like I do like stuff to continue to sound sonically kind of enjoyable. It's sort of like that we're going off topic a bit here, but bear with me. That whole kind of turntablism thing just sounded like of Eddie Van Halen lead break for 2 hours rather than an Eddie Van Halen lead break for 20 seconds in the 2 hours, you know? I think that's analogous to like really nerdy 90s hip hop freestyling. I think that's why I got there.
Yeah. I mean, I feel the same way about post Eddie Van Halen guitar in a lot of ways as well. There's a point past which some of these things, while they're incredibly impressive and I couldn't possibly do them, cease to be particularly musical.
Yeah. Okay, who would have thought we'd get to Eddie Van Halen on this episode? But I'm going to put it out there, people. Controversial, maybe, if you're like a hard rock purist, but I think the best Eddie Van Halen lead break on tape is Beat It, Michael Jackson. It's all there.
I think you could absolutely make that argument. And
he gets
in,
he gets out.
We are absolutely digressing, but I think, you know, the thing that all other things aside, Michael Jackson at his peak is an amazing showcase of is like what happens if we get the absolute cream of the crop of people we could get to be studio guys and arrangers and producers around this guy who is a stellar performer. Like how hard can we boil pop music down to a single like nugget?
And I know. You by default have included this in your description, but you know, a genius producer like Quincy Jones and sort of as some of his prime years, you know, yeah,
yeah, no, it's kind of a perfect confluence of like everything that could possibly go right for a while. So
did you own a copy of Thriller? I did when I was a kid.
I didn't buy music that was independent of my parents' music taste until I bought a copy of Nevermind in 1993.
I think I was given it for Christmas by a cool uncle. I don't think I had the purse at 6 or 7 to be going out and buying Thriller.
No, the cool person who was getting me tapes at that point was my cousin who worked for student radio in the UK, and he was getting my grandma to send me the beginning rumblings of Britpop. That was his contribution.
Hey, speaking of difficult, let's move off Michael Jackson, shall we?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Look,
just going to moonwalk back to the next topic.
We are actually coming up on time. So thank you so much for coming and being on the show. This has been a very wide-ranging discussion, but I do hope that we have maybe communicated some of our enthusiasm for this music and some reasons that people might want to check it out, even if it doesn't necessarily seem on the surface that it's for them. I guess there is a one more thing that I want to mention, which is sometimes, and I'm sure this goes for like all styles of music that come from a very particular place and time and community. But sometimes this music is interestingly time-bound in that it will talk about very specific stuff. In 70s reggae, you will find songs which are like specifically about an outbreak of people taking guns to sound systems and trying to shut them down. Later on, you get people like Lynton Kwesi Johnson talking about like specific runs of violence in pubs around sound systems. And that stuff I find really fascinating as well, just because I'm a nerd about trying to figure out where that history fits in.
Yeah, I don't know quite what you're asking me here, but what I'm hearing, I guess that's across all art that communicates ideas and language. It's that decision, conscious or otherwise, of whether you want to be bound in a particular time and place, you know, like the stand-up comedian who does kind of evergreen content, or the person that's kind of very topical. Isn't it true? Yeah, it's sort of true across all music and art, isn't it? But yes, it is very interesting. And actually, you have raised something that ties into what I was talking about before. Obviously, I didn't learn most of what I just described and talked to you about after the internet as we know it came along. A lot of it was through inevitably the music and the covers and just meeting people. But a big one with that, and this might be a nice place to end, is like, you know, I can objectively say, as someone who's obviously got through school, because I'm working at a university, got through school, okay, that I have learnt more about history and culture in a broad sense that I retain as interesting through listening to music and being into music culture than anything I kind of did in fifth form history or so on. So there's that too, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I guess I was just saying that it encapsulates some really specific histories of really specific communities and places and times that wouldn't necessarily be part of the history you would otherwise learn.
No, totally. We're both saying the same thing, and we're coming at it in different ways. You know, like the we're gonna keep going if we're not careful. I think it's Lyndon Kwesi Johnson, all that stuff. I mean, this is one example of millions. All that stuff about, I think, the riots and the race riots in the UK, you know, I learned a whole lot there. And then now with the internet, with the beauty of hearing something in song, you can learn even more.
That's right. That's the kind of urging. Go find out the next thing. Well, look, thank you again for being on the show. I like to do two things by way of wrapping up. The first is to ask if you have like specific recommendations. Obviously, go listen to Sizzler and Capleton. There was a specific album with Sizzler in particular that you pointed me to.
Yeah, let me see if I can quickly look. For someone who's released, what did I say, 50-something albums, and I probably only know four of them well. They say that I've got this one, and I'll back this claim. I think, again, the internet kind of says that Black Woman and Child, his 1997 album, is worth checking out for kind of an overview of him and what he does. Capleton, I've not really got a lot of music in an album format, but I reckon if you just went to YouTube or Spotify or wherever you go for digital music, you would hope that as a complete noob to this style that the algorithms would bring you to the sort of the big ones, you know, and there's got to be some quality in those, right?
Yeah, certainly what I found was that less so with Sizzler, but certainly with Capleton, if you are someone who uses Spotify and you use their like build me a finger quotes radio station around this artist function with Capleton in particular, you get a lot of interesting stuff.
Yeah, cool. Okay, hey, thank you for having me on. I look forward to hearing it.
No worries at all. And
that's not true. I don't like listening to myself.
Oh, well, maybe you'll make an exception. The last thing is, do you have anything that you want to draw people's attention to? You said that your podcast has recently wrapped up, but have you anything else that you want people to look at?
Okay, yeah, I did a podcast called Verbal Highs from 2016 to about a couple of years ago. I got to 145 episodes. They were long-form conversational shows, but they didn't tend to be just jump on the mic and riff like kind of Rogan famously says he does. A bit of sort of time went into preparing questions beforehand and so on. So they're kind of nice little capsules of different people of the ilk of I've been talking about today, whereas some New Zealand long-form conversational shows would tend to get on sports people or whatever. You know, I've got your DJ Moves from Freddie on there. I've got your, you know, Artist X from X City. Tends to be quite stuff around my generation, as you'd expect. So that's still available, Verbal Highs, and My Name Lewis, and I'm sure you'd find that. I'm making another podcast that's being released in the later years, so we won't worry about that. That'll be well forgotten by then. But I guess the only other thing, Hugh, is if you're interested in podcasting or becoming a podcaster, or you are a podcaster, Hugh and I go to the New Zealand Podcasting Summit every year in May, which I organise, and I'm pretty confident now attendees would say is an enjoyable event where you're looked after and learn a lot.
Oh, absolutely. You're very well looked after. It's not a super long event, which is in some ways quite good, because conferences can be overlong and cook your brain. And it's also, I think, because it's very possible to just make a podcast and throw it out to the internet and not really know how it's doing in a lot of ways. It's really great to make connections with people who are doing the same thing in whatever way they're doing it, and pick their brains and find out what they're up to and commiserate over the challenges and all of that stuff.
You've been listening to Reserved Recommendations, a radio show and podcast from Manawatū People's Radio, Te Reo Irirangi o ngā tangata o Manawatū. The show was produced and presented by me, Hugh Dingwall, and I also composed our theme music. It's called Sack Jazz, and you can find it at wolfboy.bandcamp.com. If you enjoyed this show, why not go ahead and share it with a friend? You can find the last 10 episodes of this show at npr.nz/show/reserved on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever else you get your podcasts. If you want an episode older than that, try searching for Reserved Recommendations on YouTube. You can find me at Objective Reality on Blue Sky, or send emails to objectivereality@gmail.com. You can also follow Reserved Recommendations on Facebook or Instagram. And finally, Manawatū People's Radio is a non-profit community access station. If you like this or any other piece of their fine audio programming, why not fling them a dollar or two? You can go to npr.nz/donate for more information on how to do that.